My word.
Harry Game, devised by Tony Fine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the team is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to a ringside seat at today's competitive assault upon our language by our two highly trained teams, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir. And Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. And we start off with our traditional quest through the dictionary looking for meaning. Frank, what's the meaning of the word an amanuensis?
Samuel Johnson had six of them. Milton had some. Some of them were a womanuensis, his daughters, and an amanuensis, I think, means a literary assistant who mainly takes dictation, because Milton was blind and couldn't write, and Johnson used six of these poor gentlemen on compiling his dictionary.
That's full marks. How many do you have, Frank?
Me? I have Dennis.
I was waiting for that.
Boggy, the dog, gets talked to. But no, gets dictated to, but doesn't get talked to. No, none.
You mechanise.
I have the high tech, yes.
Let us move on. Antonia, a banshee.
Well, you wouldn't want me to impersonate a banshee on this programme, because otherwise the airwaves might get very unhappy.
But it's my music.
It is a screaming, screaming Irish ghost, isn't it? Mm.
Does it scream at any particular time?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yes.
But not at the time at which we are now recording the programme.
But what does it portend when it screams?
Well, death, of course, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yes, how did I guess? I mean, not guess, I knew that it was good.
No, we'll give you two marks for screaming. I can show off here, actually, because it comes from two Irish words, born she or born she, depending whether you come from the north or the south. And it is, in fact, a female elf. Now, I didn't know there were male elves, not in mine, female elves, but it's a female Irish elf.
I've never connected sex with elves.
Gnomes,
yes.
I mean, it's a sort of Edna O'Brien.
I remarked before, you learn a lot on this programme. Sorry, Dennis, you were going to say something interesting.
No, I wasn't.
I was just saying something boring. Dillis. An afflatus.
I think that's a poetic word.
Sounds like a poem.
I think it's a kind of feeling a poet gets before he launches into verse. Is that right?
That will do, yes, because it's absolutely right.
Terribly near flatulence, isn't it?
I was very worried about this word because of my medical background, but luckily Dillis blew it away from the other meaning there. It is actually inspiration, isn't it?
What you were talking about. You won't tell us what the other meaning is.
No, but I think several people in this audience obviously know. Dennis, estivate.
That is very rude. Estivate is presumably...
It could be estivate. It's A-E-S-T-I-V-A-T-E is one alternative spelling.
Is it the opposite of hibernate?
It is. Now, I think that's a superb answer. Marks, quickly. Two marks. And now you can go on to add to that.
Shall I? Scots are people who hibernate, aren't they? Hibernian. Hiber is either or winter, and is to spend the summer, not to spend the summer fast asleep. What a glorious
prospect. Yeah, but there's one
you missed the cricket.
Well, it's to spend the summer in a state of torpor.
Yes. Torpor is good as well.
I think
torpor,
so. I'm a
good word.
Good word, yes. Good
I'm
state.
A martyr to it, yes. But that actually is the same as hibernate. It's torpor as well, I just
I suppose, yes.
But we don't associate it with hibernating because torpor feels warmer, doesn't it?
I've seen it, I'm sure, as a rather posh word for simply spending the summer. In other words, you say, you know, they estivated in Monte Carlo. That was around about the beginning of the century, didn't they? They used to use it rather grandly in that way.
Well, before we go on to the next round, I've got to give you the quotations that Frank and Dennis have been given for the last round. And Frank's is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and Dennis's is Who Was That Lady I Saw You With Last Night? Origin unknown, but certainly pre-Joe Miller's jest book.
1738.
1738, the gentleman on my left told me. Meanwhile, a round of Shakespearean clangers. Frank, what's odd about the fact that in Julius Caesar, Cassius remarks to Marcus Brutus, the clock hath stricken three?
Should be Strook.
But he was using poetic license to.
Because it was 4:30. Well, I'm sort of drying up now.
I thought you were playing with me.
Michael.
You knew the answer.
No, what's
it? There's an anomaly about.
Please, sir, teach me.
Let's give Frank a chance because I think I've been.
Caesar?
Yeah.
Oh, Caesar? Mm. Oh, of course, they didn't have. You had water clocks and things. They didn't strike till the 13th century, I do think. They just
many
splashed
many.
Before that. Yeah. And candle or water clocks. Mm. So you couldn't strike. So.
Full mark. Two marks.
Thank you.
Could have been the clock has driven three, maybe would have been accurate. Antonia, in Antony and Cleopatra, Cleopatra invites her attendant to a game of billiards. What is the anomaly?
The anomaly is that as they had to play it on sand, having no billiard tables in ancient Egypt. and as they weren't in the desert at the time, and the pyramids would have got in the way, well, I imagine the anomaly is, like with the clocks, that they didn't have billiards.
Nor even snooker. Do you know when billiards was invented?
1521.
I think that'll do. You said 1591, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yes. Everybody heard me.
So you get a bonus mark for accuracy there, I think. Yes, well done, Antonia.
Thank you very much.
Phyllis, in King John, the king declaims, Be thou as lightning in the eyes of France, for ere thou canst report, I will be there, the thunder of my cannon shall be heard. What is the anomaly in that?
Well, everything else has been about something which didn't exist at the time. So perhaps cannon didn't exist. Did cannon exist?
Well, yeah. It wasn't just cannon.
There
were cannons in the church, but not in the army.
The kind that you fire, gunpowder. Hmm. Gunpowder cannons didn't exist.
No, they didn't exist. That's the anomaly. Do you know when gunpowder was used as a propellant? It existed.
For our bacon. Introduced into this country from China.
In?
In containers.
Called shells. When did that happen?
I would have thought 12th century.
A bit later. 11th.
14th.
That's
of.
It. Two marks to Frank and Dillis. Well done. Dennis, okay. In A Winter's Tale, Antigonus asks the mariner, Our ship hath touched upon the deserts of Bohemia. Now, I acted in the question mark there because it's only asked.
Our all ship the others had a word sticking out like a sore thumb. Ships weren't in there. There was no there was no such person in A Winter's Tale called Antigonus. ships have touched upon what?
Well, shall I do it again for you? Because yes. I acted the question mark. Instead of... there is a word that sticks out like a sore thumb. I'll try and disguise it. Our ship has touched upon the deserts of Bohemia.
No such thing as a desert in Bohemia. It's all apartment buildings and high-rise flats. And
well, during the winter's tale, there were deserts there.
But well, the only other sticking out word is either there were no ships...
No coast.
That's a good idea. Antonius twigged it, eh?
Bohemia's
right. It's right in the middle, of course. Yes, it's right in the middle. It doesn't have any...
That's two very well-earned marks.
It's very hard-earned marks.
Yes, I've determined not to help you with these questions. Let's move on to a rather more literary round. Literally, only because we're going to dig into the literature again, in search of numbers. Can you recite any lines of verse in which the following numbers occur? Frank, 1,000.
The night has 1,000 eyes, the day has but one.
Well done. 2 full marks. Tell us who wrote it. Bourdillon.
A minor poet. It's a very old line, isn't it?
Yes.
It's Night Has 1,000 Eyes, I think, has been around, the thought's been around for centuries.
I thought you might have given us 1,000 pipers and oar and oar. Where do they come from?
From Scotland.
Yes, I asked for that. Antonio, where would you find 24 in some verse?
24 black verse.
You have actually... pierce the strange mind of the setter of these questions. That's the example that he gave. Peter Moore has written down 24 blackbirds baked in a pie. Well done.
Only 24 hours from Broadway.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Well, what about, wasn't that the number of years that Faust was given, number of additional years that Faust was given? That elevates the...
Only 24
extra years of pleasure and knowledge, wasn't it?
It seems a rather bad bargain. I thought he got more than that.
He got
bonus years.
Doctors don't reckon much to give you extra 24 years.
Frank, wasn't it 24 hours to Tulsa?
Yes.
Yes. Tulsa, 24 hours to Tulsa.
Are we feeling better now? Phyllis, 15. Can you find us a bit of verse with 15 in it?
Is that the one about how many men were there on a dead man's chest?
Have a guess.
15.
Well done.
15 men on a dead man's chest.
Dennis, 41.
It couldn't be the chap going to Tulsa taking the wrong road. He's now 41 hours.
The round trip.
Yeah.
41. Track 41.
Boy, no, it isn't.
It's Lizzie Borden, isn't it?
Right. Well done. Well done.
Can you give us a...
Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. And you can't... And I owe it all to Antonia.
Thank you very much.
Full marks to your team, for Antonia and Dennis.
That's all the jolly, though.
Mm. Now, double definitions. Frank, what word can be defined in these ways? The same word, two definitions. A canine malady and a glutinous painting.
Distemper.
Well done. 2 marks for Frank. Distemper. Antonia? A tall fir tree and sartorially spick and span. The audience have already got a bonus mark.
Spruce, the audience seem to think.
They've 2 marks to Antonia for good hearing.
Thank you, audience.
Dillis, a long clay pipe and a lay parish official.
Church warden.
Well done. 2 marks to Dillis and Dennis, without footwear and to no avail.
Bootless.
Well
bootless.
Done.
Bootless.
Full marks for Dennis. Mm. And now we come to the last round and Frank and Dennis's quotations. Frank, yours is Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
This is a tragic tale I tell, particularly the way I tell it. But it's a school story, and it's the tragedy of young adolescent love suddenly blighted. And it's the tragedy of a young headmaster dedicated against corporal punishment who suddenly changed it. It took place at my school, Leighton County High School for Boys, so-called to distinguish it, other essentially, from Leighton County High School for Girls, which was about 2 miles up the road. And the headmaster, Dr. Vickers, had this gorgeous wife. I mean, he was immensely old. He was about 30. But his wife, to us, the whole school was in love with her. She must have been about 27. And she had that sort of vague, lots of vague brown hair, like Christina Rossetti. And she had those sort of two bumps above her waist, which are terribly interesting to 13-year-olds. We're all desperately in love with her, and none more than my two friends. We were a close-knit trio. There was Gilbert Gunter, whom we called Gilly Gunter, because he wanted to be a ventriloquist. We all sent away, and there's magazines at the time, they had adverts at the back where you sent away. I sent away to Paris, to the Mesmer Institute. Do you remember that, Dennis? And you sent 5 shillings, and they sent you a book back by Dr. Mesmer on how to hypnotize people. And I never got it. And years later, my mother confessed that she intercepted it because she was afraid that I would have read it through and she would have found me hands outstretched, locked rigid in front of the bathroom mirror in an immovable trance. But Gunter, he sent off for the Dr. Fox's book on how to be a ventriloquist. And the third member, Colin Clues, sent off for a book on conjuring, and he tried to be a conjurer. Now, those two were madly in love with Mrs. Vickers, the headmaster's wife. I mean, really deeply. I wasn't interested in the headmaster's wife, Mrs. Vickers, at all. All I wanted to do was to found an alternative school newspaper. I wanted to be a writer. And we had the school magazine, which is full of very dull items, like football, R. Prothero is a promising right wing when he controls his urge to retain the ball. And this sort of thing. And I wanted a school newspaper which would have vital news. And all I wanted was a headline to get my paper going. And it happened, because the boys, Colin Clues and Gilly Gunter, ran into trouble. I forget what the trouble was about, but the headmaster wouldn't punish them. He wouldn't whack children at all. He didn't believe in it. So what he did was he made them do some community work. He made them plant some crocus bulbs in the little lawn, which was below where his flat was in the school. And he gave them 30 of these bulbs, and of course they started eating them, you know, because they're quite nice, they're like onions. And they ate 3 of them, and the headmaster's wife, this beautiful lady they desperately in love with, appeared and said, "You stupid boys!" They went white, their goddess talking. "You stupid boys! Plant those bulbs as you were told." So they there and then vowed revenge on her, and they exacted their revenge. It was slow revenge, but it was awful. And this was in October, and it wasn't till the following early March that their revenge became apparent. It was very, very warm February and March that year, and early in March it was the anniversary of the school, and Canon Black, who was chairman of the school governors, a rigorous churchman, went up to stay in the flat. And early that morning he opened the windows, and during the night the early warmth had developed these crocuses, and there they were in full flower. But the boys had not planted them, as they were told, haphazardly in natural style. They planted them in rows to form letters. and the letters formed words, and the words formed a message, and the message which greeted the canon's gaze was, Mrs. Vickers doesn't wear knickers. The consequence was that the headmaster broke his vow of no corporal punishment, and I had my headline, because my two lads were taken into the study, loud thwacks were heard, and my headline appeared the following morning, Clusen Gunter of the Third caned.
Thank you, Frank. Dennis, your quotation is, who was that lady I saw you with last night?
Well, because the only item that I ever sent away for in a boy's comic was a thing called a sea bacroscope. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
Which enabled you, apparently, to be able to see behind you. I never quite saw what you wanted to see behind you. I think something about that being able to see behind me sharpened an interest in history, particularly way back in history, in the time of King Arthur. And I think the most fascinating book I ever read about the times of King Arthur was one written by a German historian by the name of Heinz Zeit. Because what you get from Herr Zeit's research are some bits of information that didn't even rate a mention in Thomas Malory or T.H. White. He tells us, for example, about the fattest knight at the Round Table, the one they called Sir Lunch-a-Lot. He tells us how whenever they were all out besieging a castle, the other knights used to taunt him by shouting, sit down, you're blocking the moat. But the book's biggest revelation is the fresh light that it throws on that well-known affair between Sir Lancelot and Queen Guinevere, the one which, as you know, ended up with Lancelot having to resign from the Round Table, leave the court and take up a position with a property company in West Camelot. But because what this history discloses is that the whole relationship started because of Merlin, who, as you'll recall, was someone King Arthur employed as a sort of live-in magician. And what we learn, you see, is that Merlin's big trick, the one that he was always being called on to perform at jousting club dances, was his sawing a lady in half. And the reason that he got so many requests for that, apparently, was partly because the lady he put inside the box was always none other than Queen Guinevere herself, but it was also due to the fact that the sword Merlin used for the actual sawing bit was King Arthur's own much-publicized two-handed one, Excalibur, so that he always had to get some knight up from the audience to wield it with him. Well, at one particular cabaret, it was a charity show, actually, in aid of a knight who'd injured himself on a chastity belt. But at this show, the volunteer from the audience turned out to be that popular man about court, Sir Lancelot. Well, after he'd assisted Merlin to saw the queen into what were apparently two halves, he was instructed to wheel her top half over to stage left, and it was here, according to Camelot gossip, that the first ever whispered exchanges between Lancelot and Guinevere were said to have taken place. Now, King Arthur himself actually didn't see any of that, because he was away down the village that evening, putting pay to a certain fire-breathing dragon who was known locally as Hot Lips. But in the days that followed, Arthur did begin to suspect that his queen's affections had strayed because of those little clues that so often betray that a woman has someone else on her mind, you know, things like an abstracted smile playing round her lips, or sudden unexplained sighs, or staying out four nights in a row. When the king confided these suspicions to Merlin, he said to him, it can only be someone she palled up with last time you cut her in half. Now, any ideas who?
Of course, Merlin twigged immediately. It was the volunteer from the audience that night. But because Lancelot had kept his visor down all through the performance, Merlin didn't actually know who he was. But being such a crafty old wizard, he knew exactly what to ask Guinevere to find out. And all he did to elicit Lancelot's name was put to the Queen one seemingly casual question. That question which, as 99% of you have already guessed, the question that still lives on in British music hall. Who was that knight I sawed you with last, lady?
Thank you, Dennis. I find it hard to forgive you hindsight. Anyway, it but remains for me to tell you that today's winners are Antonia and Dennis. But Dillis and Frank will, I'm sure, come fighting back in our next programme. Until then, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. Questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Shrine and Pete Atkin.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.